Continuing then today with the series that I've been doing so far this year on the Buddha's 12-step program, which is the 12 chains or 12 conditions of one particular way of describing the process of liberation. It's a counterpoint to the very famous list in Buddhism called the Wheel of Dependent Origination, the 12 steps to how we suffer, which is the most famous list, very famous list in Buddhism. But there's also one that's less known, which is the kind of counterpoint to that, which is the way out of suffering to liberation. And the sequence are the conditions that support each other, that build on each other. So rather than just kind of becoming liberated in one big step, you create a ground, a foundation of something, and that foundation allows something else to germinate or mature through that, and that then creates the conditions for something else to mature and develop through that. And so it begins, as it should, with a suffering, a really deep appreciation of suffering. Can you hear me okay? Is it working fine? No? Please come closer, everyone, if you want to come closer. There's no problem with everyone scooting forward, or it's mostly the people far away from the speaker, right? So it begins with suffering. Buddhism puts a tremendous emphasis on appreciating suffering, not as something to be morbid about or to suffer more about, but rather as a beginning of looking for the cure of suffering, to find a solution to our suffering, or release from our suffering. And then based on suffering, it's built that allows the possibility of confidence or faith to arise, or some kind of trust in the practice of paying attention and other things. And then it builds. And the last time I came here, we talked about concentration as being a very important condition. Concentration arises out of happiness. So we need to have some conditions for happiness and well-being. And based on some sense of well-being and happiness, there can arise strong states of concentration. Based on concentration, there arises, and this is a really important transition point in the process, because at this point, the transition is from maybe what we can call more psychological aspects of practice to what's called more the spiritual side. And it's all spiritual in a sense in Buddhist, but there's a very important distinction made here. As we begin moving into insight in that which is more universal, then that just has to do with our own particular psychology, our own particular well-being. Until this point, the development of happiness, of tranquility, of calm, of ethics, have a lot to do with adjusting oneself, one's own psychology, one's own intentions and behavior. And so in a sense, we can call maybe inner psychological development, if we don't associate it too strongly with Western therapy, the word. And then at this point, after concentration, development of strong concentration, we move into the insights, which give Vipassana its name, insight meditation, which have to do much more with the universal characteristics of life, and no longer have to do with the particular issues of our own life. And this ninth stage of the wheel, of the chain, is called knowledge and vision into the way things are. And the way things are is a very important expression in Buddhism. Maybe many of you have heard it before. Buddhists like to use that expression a lot. Buddhism is all of Buddhism is, in a sense, a study of the way things are. Buddhism is a great dedication to understanding and being present for the way things are, which is quite different than the way that many people live their lives, of course. If we base our lives on memories, or base our lives on hopes, or if we judge what's going on as opposed to seeing it as it is, or we try to imagine it better, or deny its existence. All those things are moving away from just really settling deeply in the way things are. And in Buddhism, would almost say that the way things are sacred, or at least the sacred realm that Buddhism is pointing to, the sacred realm of experience, of liberation, arises out of a deep appreciation of the way things are. And so we have such expressions as, the path begins where you are. Practice always begins where you actually are. Practice is not about some distant attainment as much as it is settling into the, as you are right now, starting where you are right now, and finding that the entryway into the realms of liberation. It isn't that we're going to, we can't avoid how things are in order to become fundamentally happy. We have to in some way engage ourselves the way things actually are, the conditions of our life, how we are in our lives, what's going on in our lives, and what actually happens, what our actual experience of life is. When Buddhism went to China, by the time it came to China, Indian Buddhism had developed a huge body of philosophy, of practices, of teachings. And some of them of different schools of Buddhism. They developed different schools of Buddhism by that time. And when the Chinese received Buddhism, they kind of thought, they didn't know about some of the ins and outs of Indian Buddhism. And rather than thinking, oh, this is this school of Buddhism and that's that school of Buddhism, we'll just pick which school we like, they just took it all to be Buddhism. It's like you never heard about Christianity before, and you get, you know, you get the Catholic Church, and you get Protestantism, and you get the Eastern Orthodox Church, and you get the Mormons, and you get those people in Uganda, and you get, you know, the whole gamut to everyone, and you have to kind of make sense of it and think, you know, there must be some, you know, it must be all be one religion. So kind of that's the way the Chinese did. And it took them 500 years to begin sorting it out. They sorted it and digested it and tried to understand it. And after 500 years of digesting Buddhism, all this, there was one little saying that was produced, among others, but one kind of condensation of Buddhist teachings, which I think is worthy listening to after 500 years of effort, making some sense of it. And it's very kind of neat. The saying is, awakening, or liberation, whichever you wish to use, awakening beckons us within each phenomenal thing. Whatever exists in the world, anything you can describe is something you can experience. A thing, things of the world, our feelings, our thoughts, what we see, what we hear. That awakening beckons us in each of those things. Liberation calls us. It's like, okay, come here. And in a sense, what this means is that we have to enter into each phenomenal thing. We have to enter into the way things are in order to find our liberation. So Buddhist practice over and over again emphasizes entering where you actually are. Where are you right now? Sometimes when I do my meditation practice, I just ask myself very matter-of-factly, what's happening? Just that, you know, that's, it's that simple. What's happening right now? Coming back, what's happening right now? That's my son. That's what's happening right now. We'll see how that goes. I think it'll probably go okay. He's with my mother-in-law. How things are. We start with... And this is something which has a tremendous practical application in our life. The emphasis in seeing people as they are, seeing ourselves as we are, as opposed to memories of who they are, or hopes of who they are, or projections of who they are, or imaginations of who they are, our desires of who people are, who we should be. And a lot of people live much of their time not seeing people, their friends or their enemies or anybody, who they actually are. But we live in our memories of them, our desires of them, our projections of them, and all these things. And one of the interesting things to do coming out of meditation is if you're able to get a little bit calm in your meditation, a little bit settled, is to use your eyes, so use your ears, use your ability to pay attention very carefully and look at something that you've looked at a lot often and see if you can see it in new ways, in a fresh way, as if you'd never seen it before. If you've been living with someone for years, come out of your meditation and don't rush into the old assumptions and ideas, but kind of look at them as if you're looking at a stranger and see if you can see them as they actually are, as opposed to all that history and memory that might go into your vision of that person. And the same thing with ourselves. Coming out of meditation, can you give yourself the opportunity to be seen fresh, free of all the judgments and that you have about yourself, or the hopes you have about yourself? It's very easy to feel what it's like when other people put us in a category and don't see us as we are, but see us through a category. We're someone's spouse, we're a role, we're a certain profession or whatever. Or, you know, we said something nasty 10 years ago and we're always a nasty person in that person's eyes. And that, it's very easy to kind of feel like you're a recipient of being categorized and not being seen as you are. It's very easy to see how other people do it to themselves. You know, sometimes you wish people would get, you know, just drop their self-limiting ideas of who they are, because they're not true. And it's very easy as an outsider to see how people limit themselves by fixed ideas of who they are. And then, but it's hardest, of course, to see it in ourselves, how we do that to ourselves. And Buddhist practice is helping us to see us as we are, not as we think we are, not as we interpret we are, not how we hope things are, but just very matter-of-factly how things are. And there's something really special about that, something sacred almost, from the point of Buddhism, about you know, things actually how they are. And if you don't have the ability to drop down in things as they are, regardless of how they are, whether they're pleasant or unpleasant or terrible or beautiful, if you're not able to drop down into how things actually are in the moment, then the possibility of developing Buddhist practice, developing liberation and freedom, aren't accessible to you, aren't available to you. Those are only arise in the moment that we're here for what's actually happening. We have to be here for what's happening. So Buddhist practice always starts where we actually are. And then it continues where we actually are. And it ends where we actually are. It's not about someplace else. So in the teachings of Buddhism, there are three... what's called sometimes in both Theravada and Mahayana Buddhism, perverted views. Or maybe, I think maybe the appropriate word for this translation of these, the Pali or Sanskrit, is upside down views, rather than perverted. Misunderstandings that people commonly have about life or their experience, and this is that the upside down view of permanence, of self, and of happiness. People assume that there's much more permanence in life than there actually is. People have a misunderstanding about the nature of what the self is. And people have a misunderstanding about what happiness actually is and what it entails. And so, we take the first one, impermanence, or permanence. There's a lot of things that we take, like when we take some other person, we put somebody in a category. They were nasty to us 10 years ago. We kind of assume permanence then. They're always going to be a nasty person. We're always going to treat them as a nasty person or as a beautiful, as a wonderful person or whatever, because once upon a time they were generous. And if we assume permanence in their personality, you're not going to be able to see someone fresh and new for who they are, because personalities are constantly changing and moving and developing, and people are. My teacher in Burma loved to make the analogy of a wand, or like a fire stick that had a fire on the end, or like a flashlight maybe. And if you take the wand of fire, the torch, and you take a big circle with it fast enough, what the eye sees, it sees a circle. It sees a kind of a permanent roundabout circle. But we know that the torch is not in all those places at once. It's only in one place in that circle at a time. But there's an illusion the eye makes when things are fast enough that things are continuous and you see a continuous circle. Kind of the same illusion as we have when we look at movies. The 16 or 32 or whatever frames, 8 frames per second. There's only still pictures on the screen. But there's the illusion of continuity, because we don't see fast enough what's actually happening. So Buddhism says that we misunderstand things to be permanent when they're actually impermanent. We misunderstand things to have a self in them when there's not an inherent, substantial, continuous self here for us. We're not here for ourselves even. Isn't that something to say? In the sense of being a permanent abiding self. And many people operate on the assumption that there's a permanent abiding self here. And that Buddhism teaches that causes a lot of suffering to have that assumption. And then to assume that there can be lasting satisfaction in our experiences and our things that we have, our possessions, is considered to be one of these upside-down views. So in many ways, this kind of teaching about impermanence and self and happiness or unhappiness, suffering, a lot of different spiritual traditions can teach this or do teach this. A lot of different philosophies teach about impermanence. Heraclitus even taught about it, right? It's common in most traditions. The difference between Buddhism, perhaps, and a lot of other philosophies and teachings is that seeing how things are is not simply remaining at the kind of conventional level of how we see life, normal consciousness, but seeing how things are develops after we're able to get very concentrated. And when the mind is very concentrated, we open to a different vision of how things are than we can if the mind is not concentrated. It's like, I've been told that there's some film directors who can look at movies being projected on a screen and can see each frame at a time. Somehow they develop their concentration and their eyes to see it that way. I don't know if it's true. In the same way, a meditator develops their concentration and their ability to see, so they can see the impermanence of phenomena in a way that is not actually apparent in everyday kind of consciousness, everyday kind of awareness. And so based on strong concentration, then arises not just simply seeing how things are in conventional ways, which are very important, but what's called the stage of vision and knowledge of the way things are. And this word vision and knowledge then are very important. The word for knowledge here, jnana, it means more than just kind of conventional knowledge. It kind of means kind of like gnosis, gnostic knowledge, kind of very deep, penetrating gnosis into reality. And vision, you know, it also implies it's not simply intellectual knowing, but it's something kind of experiential. Some people will call it intuitive, but kind of a direct perception or seeing. Vipassana, after all, vipassana means to see. Insight is to see. Vision, to have developed vision. It's much more than intellectual understanding. You're not thinking, oh, this makes sense. If you're staying at that level, you haven't dropped down into what's needed in order to find liberation. As the concentration gets quite strong in meditation practice, it doesn't happen maybe, doesn't usually happen in daily sitting practice, but maybe often on retreats, very strong concentration. What we see is that nothing that we experience has any abiding permanence to it. That actually it's in constant flux. Now, one of the interesting places is you can do it with any physical sensation at all. If you find a physical sensation, and you might know intellectually it's not going to last. You know, you feel some wonderful, delightful tingling in your cheeks as you sit there meditating, or you feel some ache in your knee. You know that really well that when they finally ring that bell and you can move, that physical pain is going to go away, thank God. But so you don't know, you know it's not permanent in that sense, but there's a kind of assumption that in the moment, there's a constancy to it, there's a solidity to it, this pain or this delight or this wonderful pressure I'm feeling, it's kind of constantly there, at least for these minutes. But as you bring a more refined attention to look really closely at what these sensations are, you see that your experience of these sensations is constantly in flux. It's arising and passing moment by moment. I think some people find this most easy to see with strong painful sensations in meditation, like if your knee hurts. If you just keep avoiding your knee, avoiding what's actually happening, you won't penetrate into the nature of the pain. But if you enter into the pain directly, you find it isn't some constant, solid pain. But physical pain is always made up of a dancing variety of sensations, of pulling, of tightening, of throbbing, of stabbing, of searing, of pulling, of twisting, of, you know, the whole wonderful, you know, heat and cold and all kinds of different sensations. And you start seeing it isn't just pain, but it's made up of this series of different sensations. And if you try to get really close and really feel exactly where it is, you find, you know, from a distance it just seems my knee is on fire. But if you get really close, you say, well, it isn't the whole knee. It's just, it's actually small little points of physical pain that are actually not even staying constant, but actually dancing around. They're there in one place for a moment, and then it disappears, and then the next moment it arises somewhere else, and then disappears. And it's under states of strong concentration, we experience this not as an abstraction, which is how much of our experience of life is, but much more in the direct physical sensation of what's actually happening. And this is hugely important for the course of mindfulness practice, is learning to see that, to experience the distinction between the abstract concept and ideas we have of what we're experiencing and actually what we're experiencing directly, prior to the interpretations, prior to the abstraction we lay across it. So I'm just using pain as an example here, but it can be done with anything at all. You know, you hear a dog barking, and very quickly we might go into the abstractions and the associated thinking associated to that. Oh, that's my neighbor's dog, which is a pretty innocent recognition. But that's that neighbor who is always getting these, you know, dogs that bark all the time, all through the night. And that neighbor is so disrespectful of me. And last time they drove their car across my lawn. And pretty soon, you know, it isn't just a dog barking, but it's all the history and ideas and abstractions associated, you know, with that sound. But in the and then we get all worked up. But all there is in the moment is a dog barking. What's happening actually in the moment is often a lot easier to handle than all the assigning of meaning to it. When we assign meaning to it, interpret it, you know, it often gets a lot harder. I find this doing childcare to be very true with my son. I find sometimes early in the morning really difficult. He's a little bit, you know, wild and whatever, and I kind of, I'm old parent, right? So I'm kind of fixed in my ways. So I kind of like to get up and read the paper and be kind of quiet, but, you know. And so if I hold on to my ideas of what I like and what I want and what I need and the meaning, oh, I'm not getting this done, or because I suffer a lot, but if I just give up all those things and just be with my son in the morning and just be with the way things are, it's actually really pleasant. But it's my ideas and associations and what I want and what I expect and the meaning I apply to it that tends to cause, you know, some distress in the morning. So a very important part of Vipassana practice is learning to distinguish between the abstractions and ideas that we apply to the moment and actually what's happening. As the concentration gets stronger, we see how this works in more and more subtle levels in our life. It's not just simply how it relates to child rearing, but you see how it relates to the details of each moment of sensation, each moment of sensory experience, each moment of experience, each moment of thought, each moment of mind states, each moment of an emotional state. You don't see, when the concentration is strong, you're no longer looking at an emotion from the point of view of your biography, the stories and ideas and how it is relates to your psychology. But you see, start seeing what's called the universal characteristics of the emotion, that which all emotions share, and all humans share when they have an emotion. And that is the emotion is impermanent. From the point of view of our abstractions, or being somewhat removed from the emotion, thinking about it or wondering about it, or it can seem like it's there for, you know, pretty solid. But if you bring your attention really carefully to actually experience the direct experience of the emotion, you'll find an emotion is very much in flux. It's constantly moving. That's what emotion means, right? In motion. It's constantly moving. And then when something is constantly moving and constantly changing and arising and passing moment by moment in our experience, it forces us to have a new relationship to that experience. It forces us, because if our normal relationship is one of holding on to permanence and wanting things to be permanent, relating whether consciously or unconsciously, oh, this is a constant thing, this is a permanent thing, if we're holding on to that or resisting it or clinging to it based on the assumption of permanence, and if it's not permanent, it's going to be very hard to keep that clinging going without a very high cost. And so to drop down in a strong state of concentration into an experience where everything in our experience is changing all the time. And this is what happens in deep vipassana practice. Everything in the moment is in constant flux. It's like being in the middle of a river and you're trying to grab on the river, you know, hold on to the water as if you were dear life, you know, like it doesn't work. You can't be in the river and kind of hold on to the water as if the water's going to hold you up and save you. All you have to do, you have to learn to float. Then it's safe to be in the river. But until you've learned to float, it can feel very scary to let go of all the things we cling to, because this is what we think we need to have for our permanence. So it's a really, really a remarkable experience in meditation to drop down to this level where every possible thing we can experience is seen as being impermanent, constantly in flux. Some people will experience a lot of fear at this point, because much of the way we get security in life comes from clinging to some notions of permanence. Our sense of self is often tied to holding on to something. Oh, this is who I am. As long as I'm this way, then I can orient myself to the world, I can be safe in the world, I can protect myself. But that needing to be a certain way requires that to kind of be somewhat constant. And if you look at it very carefully, you see that maybe you saw that just an abstraction that you have. And abstractions aren't very useful. And if you drop down to what's actually going on, you see who you are is a constant stream of flux and change. It doesn't make any sense to hold on to the flux. And then where do you look for security? It can be very frightening to have this experience in meditation. But it also can be tremendously delightful and tremendously liberating. It isn't inherently frightful. It's frightful because of the way in which we've kind of misunderstood where our security and well-being resides. And so this experience of things constantly in flux lends itself to begin thawing the way in which we've frozen our grip on reality and on self. And it moves us in the direction of trust. And this, I think, is the real value of these deep insights, the three basic insights that come with deep vipassana practice: the deep insight into impermanence, the deep insight into no self, and the deep insight into unsatisfactoriness. It lends itself to an experience of trust, because when you really see deeply these experiences, these insights, these characteristics of reality, of our experience, you can't cling. Now, some Buddhists will make the three characteristics their dogma. And I've heard many Buddhists, both in Asia and America, go around and talk about these three characteristics of impermanent suffering and no self in the way that maybe Christians would talk about the Holy Trinity. You know, they hold on to it. Philosophical categories to understand everything. Everything gets referred back to these three characteristics. And they kind of take it on as kind of abstractions they didn't apply to everything else. I don't think that's what these things are supposed to be meant meant to be taken in practice. It's okay to have some permanence until the San Andreas Fault shakes here. You know, we're sitting on top of it, right? It seems pretty solid until it shakes. But the deep insight into the three characteristics that arises out of deep meditation practice is meant to lead us, is one of the ways, one of the very dramatic ways, or very powerful ways, of the mind and the heart learning to trust, learn to let go of all that clings to. And it's that letting go and dropping into a trustful place, which I think is really the fundamental value of this knowledge and vision of seeing how things actually are. And if you can do that in deep meditation practice, of learning to let go of all that grip that you hold on to, learn to trust very deeply in meditation, then you bring that some of that trust with you back into your normal everyday life again. And that little bit of trust you begin finding in meditation then begins massaging your clingings and your clingings and your resistances and your fears that we carry with us through everyday life. And begin kind of slowly letting go of them and feeling it's safer and safer and more and more trustworthy or trustable to be in life in a transparent, undefended, unprojected, unresistant way, just open to what's actually here. To be open to how things actually are as opposed to resisting it or holding on to it. Just open. It's often said the experience of impermanence often comes first for some people. And when you realize that everything in our experience is impermanent, that there's nothing you can find in your direct experience which qualifies for any permanence, then can you place a self on that, on any of that stuff? Does it make sense to make a self out of something which is impermanent? It's only here actually for just a flash. It's really fascinating. In very deep states of concentration, you see moment by moment that things are just arise very quickly, just in a flash. And then they're gone, and then they reappear, and they're gone. Does it make sense to call that a self? And most people will say that no, it doesn't. And it's quite common in deep meditative practice for people to come and say, I can't find a self. I thought there was a self, but I can't find one. Or there was when I was sitting one long retreat, it was really obvious to me that everything was in flux, everything was changing, except for the awareness that knew that things were changing. So I went to my teacher and said, I think I should be a Hindu instead of a Buddhist, because the consciousness seems to be permanent. And he said, which, you know, the main thing Buddhist teachers are supposed to say, he said, look more closely. And so I looked more closely until finally I saw that consciousness is of the same nature. It arises and passes like everything else. And the teaching, the third characteristic of suffering, these are the three universal characteristics of all experiences. So they're kind of a big deal for Buddhists, right? The universal characteristics of anything you can experience in the world is that it's impermanent, there's no self there, and it's has suffering as part of it. Now that's, you know, kind of disappointing for some people. What about happiness? Buddhists would say even in the midst of happiness, there is something, maybe the word shouldn't be suffering. The word dukkha here maybe should be translated as unsatisfactory. And this is maybe some people say this is kind of a downer. What's Buddhism kind of pulling the rug out of my happiness? I think it was a cave in Thailand, there was a Western monk who lived there for many years. And he finally, as an old man, died in his cave. And they found maybe a painting on the walls or in his journal or something, kind of cartoon. And he had drawn a cartoon of a monk dancing and singing, kind of leaping up and kicking his feet together or something. He was really happy. It was obvious this was some ecstatic. And written underneath there, written kind of in a little thought bubble or something, was him saying, oh, what joy to realize there's no true happiness. What do you think of that? So you pull the rug from underneath your happiness and you end up being joyful. But the idea here is that all our experiences are unsatisfactory as places to put our permanent, to hang our hat on, or to put all our eggs in that basket, or to depend on anything for our ultimate satisfaction or ultimate happiness, for our sense of self. Everything is unsatisfactory because it's impermanent. It cannot provide you with any lasting satisfaction. We can certainly enjoy the happiness that comes in the moment, but if we expect that happiness to last, it's a setup for suffering. And when you realize that when you stop holding on to it and expecting it to be there, there can actually be greater appreciation of the happiness. When you realize that you're suffering is also impermanent, also, you know, just passing through. often that can make it a lot easier. So sometimes when we're having a very difficult time with my son, a few times, we did this for a while, my wife and I would look at each other and we would say, I think we're having one of these moments now. And that just makes it so much easier. Just, oh, it's one of those times. As opposed to, if we don't say that, it's kind of like, I'm embroiled in the midst of this, like, it's going to be this way forever. You know, I mean, how could it ever, you know, that's kind of the unconscious, almost assumptions, like, oh my God. But as soon as we say, oh, this is just one of those times when it's like this. Oh, well, you know, it's just one of those times. We can handle this, and it's a lot easier then. So nothing has any inherent lasting satisfaction to it, is part of what it means, this third characteristics. So this is moving from psychology to what's called the universal characteristics, into what's universal. And this is a very important transition in the practice of Vipassana mindfulness, is when we learn to move away from psychology, away from our biography and what we think we need and all that, and learning to see things from the universal perspective, what's universally true for all beings and all people. And it's when we see that what's universal, because it's universally true, and that we can begin finding some universal freedom or happiness. If you don't see what's universal, it's very hard to find that. So when we talk about insight meditation, which is a common word for vipassana, it doesn't mean it's insight with a capital I. There's a lot of insights you might have in the course of the practice. You might have insight into, you know, why you react a certain way, or insight into what happened to you as a child and how that affects you now, or insight, you know, many, many different kinds of insights and self-understanding that might come. They're all very valuable. But in a sense, we might call those insight with a small I if we reserve insight with a capital I as the insight into that which is universal and not unique to you as a person. And the next stages of this 12-step program of liberation are dependent on beginning to see things in the universal characteristics, the universal level. So we'll talk about that next time I come in 2 weeks. And so today we talked about the stage of vision and knowledge of things as they are. Very, very important for Vipassana students. So any questions about that? Is that clear enough? Or yes?
Could you talk a little bit about what not no self means when you're not addressing it to a particular individual? When you say all things have no self.
All dharmas have no self. Stephen's asking, what does it mean when we say all things have no self, when we're addressing it as something else besides a person? The way that this formula goes, the formulaic way it's sometimes chanted, these three characteristics, it says all conditioned phenomena, all fabricated phenomena are impermanent. All conditioned, fabricated phenomena are unsatisfactory. And then it makes this interesting change, and this is what I think Stephen is referring to. Then the formula is, all things have no self. So when you hear our normal Dharma talks, you think that this formula should be, all things are no self, all things are impermanent, all things are... all dharmas, you know, all dharmas, things. All things are impermanent, all things have no self, and all things are unsatisfactory. But the way the Buddha said it was more nuanced. He said, all fabricated things, and pretty much everything we know about is fabricated. So that's, you know, basically all things. But he said, all fabricated things are impermanent, all fabricated or conditioned things are unsatisfactory. And then he said, all things are no self. And the reason, as been explained to me, that the Buddha said this, or why it's said this way, is that Nibbana or Nirvana is understood to be permanent. Nirvana is unfabricated. It's not created or made or conditioned. It just, It's unfabricated reality, in a sense. And so it's not a thing in the normal sense. It's kind of a little complicated. It's not a thing, but it's a thing. You know, we call it, you know. But so nirvana has no is permanent. Nirvana is happiness. Sometimes it's equated with happiness. You don't want to say that nirvana is impermanent. You want to say nirvana is unsatisfactory. It's the ultimate satisfaction. But the Buddha did not want to say that nirvana was self. So he said all things, including nirvana, do not qualify as a self. That's why it's said that way. He said, you want to ask more?
In what sense can you say a thing has a self? What is a self in this relationship?
I think the way the Buddha usually described it is a self is a is the controlling agent. The self is anything that you can control. So, because one of the famous teachings he gave a number of times, he says, is your body yourself? Can you control your body? Can you stop yourself from aging? So you can't control your body so well. I mean, a little bit you can. You can go to the gym a little bit. But you know, body's mostly out of your control. So that doesn't qualify as a very good self. Are your emotions something you can control? You know, maybe a little bit, but not that dramatically. You can't have them. So emotions don't qualify as a self. So it goes through everything. So your thoughts, can you control your thoughts? Me, my monkey mind? No way. So they're not me because they're uncontrollable. They're kind of just random thoughts. And so you realize that nothing in your experience qualifies as a self because you can't control it. And then at some point you turn around and say, well, maybe this idea I have of me being the person who's in control, or me who's not in control, maybe that's who I am. Some sense, but then you see that also. So any assumption of identification, must be who I am, is the notion of self, as I understand it. I think it's that simple. But Stephen has, you know, studied and practiced a lot, so maybe you should try to say a little bit. If you have a different understanding of what I said so far, I'd like to hear.
No, I agree with what you said, but it's the question of how that translates into some non-conscious entity that says, well, what is the nature of the self of a non-conscious entity?
I mean, what's the self of this bell?
Yeah.
Why is this interesting?
Because if things have no self, what's the nature of the self they don't have?
What's the nature of the self that they don't have? Well, Mahayana Buddhism made a lot of this. And they would say the essential nature of the self that they don't have is pure. They used the word purity a lot in the early Mahayana texts. And what they were saying is that it's empty.
Of what?
Of self.
Circular
object. Well, and the Mahayanas went on sometimes and more refined and said that it was empty of svabhava. Svabhava is sometimes translated in English as inherent existence. There's no inherent existence in anything. There's no inherent existence in a table, because sometimes a table is a table, sometimes it's a massage desk or table. Sometimes it's a bed if you put a mattress on it. Sometimes it's a doorstop if you put it up against an open door. Sometimes it's, you know, you turn it upside down and put some netting around it, and it's a playpin, you know. There's nothing inherent in a table that makes a table. What makes a table is the way we see it and use it. So there's nothing inherent in the table. There's no tableness in the table. So they say there's no inherent existence in the table except from the assumption of how we use it, the functionality we give to it. So the Mahayana Buddhism, they wanted to go further than say there's no self in the table. They wanted to say there's no inherent existence in anything. All things are empty in that way. So the Mahayana Buddhism, they put tremendous emphasis on the emptiness of all things. That even though there's some solidity to this, inherent in this bell is its emptiness.
That makes it sound a little bit like what the problem is the designation of the thing rather than the thing, I hesitate to say, itself.
Let's back up a little bit. When I talk about the three characteristics, I kind of make a little nuanced description of them, which may probably went by most of you. Many Buddhists will say that the universal characteristic, the three characteristics of all things, is that they're impermanent, there's no self in them, and they're unsatisfactory. I don't feel so comfortable saying that myself. I don't, because that's a metaphysical statement. That's making a metaphysical statement about the nature of reality. And my preference of Buddhism, and there's certainly lots of ancient Buddhists who had this take, and it could be argued the Buddha had this had the same philosophy, was that Buddhism is not offering a metaphysics about the nature of reality. And that's not really the point. Buddhism is not offering it's what may be unsatisfying those people who feel like having metaphysics or understanding of reality is a really important part of their religion. What Buddhism is offering is a practice, in a way, of becoming free, in a sense, psychologically free. And so the nuanced distinction I make is, rather than saying that the universal characteristic of all things is the three characteristics, and if you drop down into this deep level of meditation where you experience a sensory level, moment to moment, how we actually experience things, we see that it's impermanent. In that level. It certainly, you know, probably is going to last, you know, long enough for me to use it today. So it has some permanence. But when you drop down to this very strong meditative level of impermanence, where you actually drop down to the experiential level, as opposed to any of the abstractions and ideas, the value of that experience is not that it gives you some sense of, you know, the true nature of reality, which is how some Buddhists take it. The value of that experience is that it teaches you to let go. And for me, there's a big difference between taking some deep meditative insight, which is only really true in that deep state of concentration. There's a difference between universalizing that and claiming, because of that meditative experience, that all things are that way when you come out of meditation, versus learning how to let go of clinging in that state, learning how to trust in that state, and then that sense of trust and liberation that comes from that, then that is transferable into our normal everyday life. Because the deepest levels of trust, I believe, that a person can experience are difficult to experience. And this is one of the powerful ways that we have, through this deep meditative practice, of massaging the deep, deep, subtle forms of attachment that make up sometimes seemingly almost the core of who we are. So that's a distinction I make. So I'm not very interested in metaphysics, so the nature of this bell doesn't interest me so very much. What I'm interested in is, you know, maybe physicists might be very interested in the nature of the bell. What I'm interested in is the nature of how I experience the bell. I mean, in a worldly way, there's a lot of worldly wisdom in impermanence, right? And Buddhism is supposed to be helping us at all levels of our life. And so the worldly understanding of impermanence is very helpful. Like Ajahn Chah, he had a beautiful cup that he liked a lot. And someone came to him and said something like, you know, how could you, you know, great enlightened spiritual master, have a preference for your cup? And he said, oh, it's okay. I already see it as broken. So he already assumed that it was broken, or it was about to break. So he appreciated it more fully that way, but he wasn't attached to it lasting. But that's a kind of worldly wisdom. And there's a lot of worldly wisdom of impermanence that, you know, you can go a lot of places and get. And death and sickness, old age, all kinds of things teach us that we have to let go of the notion of permanence. But the path of Vipassana Technically, in Burma, in some modern schools of Theravada and Buddhism, Vipassana practice doesn't begin until we start seeing the universal characteristics, and the concentration is that strong. Until then, it's mindfulness practice. And when the mindfulness gets coupled with very strong concentration, and you start seeing this and a few other things, then becomes Vipassana practice. Is this satisfying, Stephen, this response to you?
It's good enough. Yeah.
It's good enough? Isn't that enlightening? It's good enough. Are we going to settle for good enough? Noah?
Could you comment some more on your insight that consciousness is not permanent? You mentioned that as an insight in meditating, while you're meditating. Did I hear that?
Yeah.
So I hear the statement, but I kind of like to.
Well, it's
are you equating consciousness with self?
Or? Well, it's very easy to do that, right? Many people do, and so what the from a Buddhist point of view, the corrective of taking consciousness as self is to see that consciousness also is impermanent, that arises and passes, and there's various levels of this. The most common level I talked about is that because the Buddhists distinguish say when there's a sound, that sound produces sound consciousness. And the consciousness of sound only exists with the existence of the sound. So sound is born, the sound passes. The consciousness of sound arises and it passes. Sound consciousness is impermanent. Seeing arises with the object seen, and as object seen passes away, seeing consciousness passes also. But as practice gets deeper, that's kind of seen very early in Vipassana practice, but especially if you kind of adopt that Buddhist category of awareness. But often it can be the sense that the consciousness is all pervasive and kind of permanent, kind of like a screen. There's all the stuff happening on the screen, but the screen is permanent. And there can be that sense also. And the Buddhist corrective to that is when you see that screen also passes away, also gets dropped or fades away or drops entirely. And then it comes back again. So to see the impermanence of that screen also. And then you say, oh, that's not self either, because that can't be self, because that's also impermanent. You have to be very careful when the Buddhists talk about self that we don't use our Western references for the word. Kind of what Buddhists are talking about when talking about self is something which is permanent. Impermanent selves you're allowed to have. And as I think Tanisiro talked about last week, implied, is that some of the process definitions of self you find in Western psychology, there's no, Buddhists don't have any problem with that. But then there's often misunderstanding when a process psychologist talks about the self as a process, but they don't use the word process. You say that, you know, you need to strengthen yourself or you need to understand yourself. The Buddhists then will, oh, they're talking about the same word we talk about, and, you know, there's no self, and what are they talking about? But so the process, certain understandings of self are quite compatible with Buddhism. But any notion of a fixed, permanent, abiding self are not compatible.
Is that equivalent to when you have the notion of self as emptiness, then obviously there's no consciousness?
Oh. Well, you can't have a notion if there's no... I think that my son is beginning to want me. My mother-in-law is trying to get in. So I think that we'll answer questions about the nature of consciousness when things are a little bit different than they are now. So thank you all very much for today.